Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello, Colly Ennis, how are you?
How are you, Killa Kinsella? Welcome back to my beautiful shed full of animals. How are things?
And we're back with...
It's me, it's Rob Gandola, always an unwelcome visitor here in Colly Shed.
Drinker of tea and talker of frogs.
Yes, and coffee usually more than tea.
Oh yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Lots of
I have to stock more coffee for you.
You do.
You're the only person who comes to this house who likes coffee.
I like coffee.
So, froggies, back to it. So the last time we were here, we were talking about exploding toads and we were talking about some of the nasties that are out there that are affecting frogs worldwide. What would you say is the biggest threat to the Irish populations of amphibians in general?
In Ireland, for sure, it's habitat modification, habitat change and loss of breeding and, well, just loss of habitat, full stop. So it's not just wetlands, it's got to be the associated habitat. So like your long grass, your hedgerows, your forest edges, you can't have one without the other because they, like our amphibians, they spend so much time on land that to just put back wetlands and not give them anything to not give them anywhere to live or feed for the rest of the year is just, you're asking for trouble. It's just going to fail miserably. So yeah, for sure, the biggest threat is habitat loss. However, what we know from our own experiments, from our own prattling around and years of advice and talking to people, like no matter whether you're in the country or whether you're in the city, is our amphibians are definitely resilient. So little small changes in your own little garden and your neighbour's garden can have huge effects. And I think that's going to be our saviour here. Irish people are great at doing a bit of graft when they're motivated to do so. And like, we've been to sites, you've been invited to give talks at sites. Like, I love our definition of talks is hands on. Get into that ditch and show all these kids here how you, like, what you do when you're,
yeah, we're proactive when you're rather than reactive. And I like
that's
that
cool
about our group. Yeah.
Yeah.
So we actually, just so people know, we actually run the Herpetological Society of Ireland. Even though I have trouble saying that word sometimes.
Herpetological Society.
Yeah, herpetology. So yeah, things that crawl. So yeah,
that's where herpes comes
from. Yeah, herpes, yeah. That's
really
right.
Yeah,
so
the itching, crawling skin thing. Yeah. Latin and Greek, herpeton.
Herpeton,
I think.
Yeah, that's very good. And what? Nerds!
STIs!
It's a funny thing, you know, when you ring up a school and you go, I'm from the Herpetological Society. Can I put a pond in there? But no, again, as Rob was saying, what we like to do is get in. Like my old school, for example, Drimnagh Castle invited us over to give some talks. And I said, while I'm here, you have a nice big field out there. And I used to collect frog spawn there when I was a kid. And I know there's some there. So they invited me back. We got a small budget, put a pond in for them. And now it's a regular breeding site. Brilliant. It has been for the last 4 years now. So very cool to see small little changes like that can make major difference to local populations and bring them right back from the brink.
Do you know what worries me, though? Is so many people keeping all sorts of reptiles in their homes. And I just worry about escapes and escapees. But also, I know that people illegally import animals. And, like, how can we... We need to talk about the pet trade, I guess, don't we?
Yeah, well, so for me, I have a foot in conservation. And I'm very much a hobbyist. And I do keep pets. But being a conservationist, it's a big worry for me. Because I do see a lot of the Asian species of sallies and frogs coming in.
Salamanders?
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, salamanders. So, I mean, I do worry because, like, I don't want to see the smooth newt, for example, is particularly susceptible to the nasty chytrid virus or fungus. And I don't want to see that our native species suffer. But I'd also don't want to be the guy who tells people what they should and shouldn't do. I think you have to be a responsible owner, pet owner. You have to be very careful about what species you keep, where you get them from, make sure they're captive bred, make sure they're disease free. And it's easily done. It's very easily done. It's being a conscientious keeper and looking after your pets, disposing of their water correctly, stuff like that. There's a big campaign going on at the moment over in mainland Europe, which is directly addressing this, isn't it?
Yeah, the Berne Convention, which people would say, that's not an organisation, that's a framework and policy. But the people behind the Berne Convention are promoting this biosecurity awareness.
Remind me what the chytrid fungus is.
So this salamander chytrid fungus, the Dendrobatidis salamandrivorans, which essentially means salamander eater, it's been traced back now to Asian salamanders and the pet trade coming into, like, and the biggest outbreak was in the Netherlands. Essentially, they've lost nearly 97% of their wild fire salamander population.
So are fire salamander also native to the Netherlands?
Yeah, they're native to Europe. And there's loads of little subspecies, and a lot of them will be elevated to full species now. So they've got this huge range kind of from continental France right the way across into the Middle East and North Africa. So fire salamanders, they're very diverse, but they're also like very widespread. And what they think now is that because Germany and Holland have these huge pet shows, and a lot of these captive animals go into sale, that people are buying the animals there, but they're not implementing their own personal biosecurity. So somehow this salamander eater fungus has gotten into the wild population of fire salamanders. They've no resistance to it because it's of Asian origin, and it's essentially knocked them on the head. It's virtually wiped them out in the Netherlands. It's been huge, decimated.
Wow. Yeah.
The actual zoospore, so the thing that actually infects the fire salamanders, it's almost impossible to destroy. Like, you can heat it, you can cook it, you can, like, it's, we were at a conference there 2 years ago where they were talking about how difficult it is to actually get rid of this. So it's virtually, once it's in the soil and in wetlands in the wild, you can't get rid of it. Like,
it retains its presence in the soil for years afterwards, and it's just sitting there. So even reintroductions don't work.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. So you're looking at an aliens kind of thing. Like, the only way to be safe is nuke it from orbit type thing. Like, it's impossible to get rid of. So this is nasty. And what the Berne Convention have come out and said, look, we're not going to ever get rid of the pet trade. And no one should try it, right? So it's like freedom of will. If you want to have nice stuff and you can afford it and look after them, go for it. But you have to be bloody responsible. Mm. And that means treating your water, treating your cage furnishings, watching your animals, you know, quarantine new animals when you bring them into a collection. Mm. And it's very simple stuff. Like, nobody's asking you to chop off an arm, you know?
Yeah.
It's keep stuff on paper towels, put bleach in the water for 48 hours before you dispose of it. You know, very simple things that most keepers won't have any issue with. Mm. But it's when you have an unregulated trade, which we have here, is where you can walk into a shop and buy anything. And depending on the shop, if you're lucky and you go to a good shop, you'll get good advice.
Mm.
But some of these places won't know what they're even selling. It's a name on a list. Mm. They'll know roughly where it's from.
It's hard to understand because, I mean, you have to have a dog license. You have to have your dog and your cat chipped. But you can have a crocodile in your bath.
That's a whole other podcast. We could talk. I mean, we might have you back to talk about that some other time. But I mean, look, we always say we're not the pet police. You know what I mean? We don't have to be doing that. But as conservationists, you do have to be trying to, and, you know, kind of had heated discussions with some of our friends who are big hobbyists who would be like, look, I'm entitled to keep whatever I want. That's, again, fine. But just be hyper aware that you could be bringing in something into the country that is wiping out our own native stuff. And just because it's called the common frog or the common newt, it doesn't mean that they're any less special than the thing you're keeping in your tank. They've evolved here. They're at the very edge of their range. They're really cool, interesting animals, and they deserve the chance to live out their existence in this country without us being dickheads about them bringing in these nasty things that will kill them.
See, that brings up an interesting point that I'm interested in, which is, I have a right to do whatever I want. I don't think you do. For people who want to keep animals, and if they don't necessarily know how to keep them correctly, that's, for me, a ridiculous arrogance on the part of humans to take on these creatures and maybe not know how to give them the best life possible. So if you flip it and you say, well, the animal has the right to have the best life possible, but also the native animals have a right to keep on living and not be infected with other things. And for me, that brings in, when it does need more regulation, obviously. If people want to do that, start to think differently about it, but also we need to know who's doing what.
It's a, it's such a complex issue. There's so many layers to it. But if you look around this shed, every snake I have in here, I didn't go out and buy. They were all handed to me by people who got them and didn't want them then. So, you know, if you're going out to buy a snake, as you said, why are you doing this if you're not prepared to give it the full, happiest existence that you can? It's not a fashion accessory. But this is the kind of the attitude that you have to deal with. Again, though, on the flip side of that, there's hundreds and probably thousands of people who keep exotic pets, keep them well, look after them and care for them. So I don't want to be hitting them because of a few idiots as well. So again, it's so complicated. I think regulation is the key. We've had this discussion, and maybe even like a small fee just to have a license to say, look, I own this and I have it here. And make somebody a little bit more responsible. But again, that's another podcast. You know, we're getting off the amphibians. But, you know, just to, especially, so say if you get a fire salamander in, if you have to have the paperwork with it, a license to say you have it, and then your top proper biosecurity, what's the harm in that? How hard is that to do? You know?
But also, for you guys being educators and science communicators, if you encourage people to think about life from the side of the animal, like through the eyes of the animal, rather than just, I want this, I'm going to have it. If they start thinking about, oh, okay, this animal has rights. If we can get the next generation to start thinking differently about animals and how it's not just about us having animals in our lives, it's about thinking about the lives of animals, because they have a right to be here too and have a right to a proper life. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And I think especially with getting back to our native amphibians, that's the big thing. To put people in the head of a frog or a newt. It's a weird thing to say, but you're kind of saying, even when we're getting back to like talking about people saying, do you remember you used to collect frog spawn? And that, oh yeah, I do. And right, well, you give them that little bit of magic. Oh, I remember that when I was a boy or a girl doing that. That was great. And then you go, right, well, they're in trouble and this is how you can help them.
Yeah,
it's that, just getting that association and you know, bringing them around to thinking as a frog in a weird way.
Exactly. I would like to think as a frog.
If we can attract an audience with the exotics, but give out advice on how to best manage for natives, then I think it's a win-win. Getting into the other side of things with legislation, like where do you start? And this is a massive argument. It's like, should they start with the shops? Irish pet shops don't have to have a license. You go to the UK, all the shops have to be licensed. Why don't they have to be here? Because at least a shop isn't something that moves house or doesn't do it frequently. A shop doesn't put things in a shoebox and take it home on a whim. You know, a shop is somewhere where you can send inspectors to do, like zoos, you know, license the shops first and then maybe drop it down onto people who engage in like buying pets and the captive trade after that. You have to start somewhere, and usually a top-down approach in that situation, because it makes the shops be responsible.
And I prefer to go somewhere to get an animal if I knew that I was going to get good advice and if I knew they were healthy.
Yeah.
I'd be much happier as a pet owner.
Yeah. And I mean, like, this is how complex it is. This is a really simple thing that I was thinking about. Goldfish are exotic pets. Finches, budgies. Do you need a license for a goldfish? How far do you go down the line?
You have to go all the way down the line. Yeah, but it's
so complex, though. I know it's such a cop-out to say that, but it's not. It's the facts is, it is a really complex issue. And like, a goldfish is just as dangerous and invasive as a turtle or whatever.
But if you just inspect them as they're coming in, if you have people are passing them on to the hobbyists, if they're licensed and if they're following all the rules and making sure everyone's healthy and well cared for and giving proper information, so that's half the battle.
Yeah, exactly. And I think when you look at it, you know, it's always going to come down to resources. Who's going to police it? You know, the dog license thing is very poorly enforced. We know that, you know, but there's very few wardens.
Horses wandering
horses
Dublin.
Well. So if you make it like a top down, so importers and shops first, you only need like a handful of inspectors. Two inspectors could probably do all of Dublin in a day.
Yeah.
You know?
But so I mean, if the UK can do it, if the Netherlands can do it, it means at some point we could do it. So it could be a long term thing where we have that aspiration and then it happens.
Sure. That'd be cool. You know, it would be cool. But again, you know, it's one of those things that you would have to get the bottom of it and you have to have the enthusiasm on government level, let's be honest,
yeah,
to get it
exactly.
done, you know. And that's an issue, you know, yourself, because people don't want to take on workloads. They're probably stressed out as it is because they're undermanned, and, you know, and then there's so many different departments. Do the Department of Agriculture take it on, or do Parks and Wildlife take it on? Who wants extra work in their already stressed work environment? So, you know, it's one of those things. Hopefully it comes along. I think we do need it. Rather than kicking the can down the road, it's better to be, again, proactive rather than reactive. We don't want an outbreak in this country. Me and Rob don't want to be walking around looking at sites that there is a chytrid or a rhinovirus outbreak, because that's going to be heartbreaking. But let's be honest, and we've been saying it for a while, it's coming. And it's probably coming sooner than we think, you know. And then you're talking about that hitting already stressed populations. So, you know, it's not going to be pretty.
Because I know, you know, anecdotally of the Postal Service picking up various animals like terrapins or customs.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
What?
It was a spitting cobra.
No way.
In the post office, in the central post office.
Really? Posted?
Yeah, posted, yeah. We know that there's venomous snakes being sent in the post.
God.
And anything else. So, like, it's such an issue. Like, it's, like, you know, you're affecting all different levels of everything, from governmental agencies to just private owners. Like, doing nothing, I think, is the worst we could do.
Doing nothing is
worse than doing something, as long as the something is proactive rather than reactive and nasty. Like an outright ban, because outright bans drive everything underground, and then you're never going to get a handle on it.
Exactly. You have to work with what's...
For sure.
You have to work with human psychology as well.
And I mean, you tell people they can't keep anything.
Of course.
It's going to probably boom the trade, if anything.
Exactly.
So, I mean, it's, you know, it's juggling. That's what it is. It's getting everybody on the same page and keeping everybody happy at the same time, and hopefully coming to a sensible and, you know, again, proactive conclusion to what we should do, you know.
Sorry, say that again.
So, yeah, just behind you here, Rob. You see me?
You've just stood. Oh my God! You've just stood up and opened a terrarium there, and there's a tiny frog. What is that?
That's a White's tree frog, and there's a male in the background. Or no, female in the background. That's the male.
Beautiful.
Have you ever seen a happier animal when it's sleeping? It looks so content. They actually look like little Kermits. They're Australian species, yeah.
The whites, they're that from that. They're the Littorias, yeah.
So there's foliage in there, and it's sitting on a big leaf, and it's just looking at us. And about what, 2-3 centimeters?
Yeah.
And so the one behind is bigger.
The female's bigger than the male.
Okay.
So that's generally the case with frogs. Apart from the pixie frogs, they're the only ones off the top of my head I can think of where the sexual dimorphism is reversed.
Yeah.
But generally, for most frogs, the female's bigger because she has to carry all those eggs.
Okay.
And the male just has to carry his little bit of, you know what I mean,
saucy
jizz. So, yeah.
They are so beautiful.
They're gorgeous, they really are. And when you knock off the lights, so I have a a light system here, so I give them a day and night cycle. Yeah. You knock off the lights, give them a spray, and then they're down munching on everything that moves. So yeah,
fantastic.
Really delighted with them.
How long have you had them?
I've had them about 3 weeks.
Have you?
Yeah. So yeah.
Where'd you get them?
My walked past my local pet store, and I was like, you know what? They are gorgeous. And I don't do it very often, but right. I've always wanted some white tree frogs. So yeah, really happy with them.
White tree frogs. We have a tree frog at home, but I think it's a Mediterranean tree frog.
Yeah, it looks like one of the European species. I couldn't quite place it, but yeah. I didn't really have a look at it for that long because.
And he came in somebody's hand luggage. No, yeah. Hand luggage. Okay. Or cargo luggage, rather, on a plane. So he's picked up by customs and they passed him on to us. But he's beautiful.
In my living room, I have a big common toad.
Do you?
But it's the Bufo spinosus. So it's kind of a subspecies of the common toad. But they get
full species now.
It's a full species now? Yeah. Brilliant. See, everything changes. Science is so dynamic. But it's one of the bigger ones. So the English toads will be quite smallish, but these ones get really chunky on the continent. And that came in some vegetables from Portugal.
Wow.
So it's a tiny little toad about that size, and now it's nearly a dinner plate size. It's huge.
And on Thursday, I had to go to my local pet shop and pick up a tarantola, so a crocodile gecko, because it had just come in off a shipment from Spain with flowers.
My God, what does that look like?
So I'll have to send you a picture. It's amazing. It's like a miniature, if you can think of like your average gecko, and then cover it with loads of cool, kind of knobbly, spiky bits. So that's why they're called, the common name is a crocodile gecko. It's awesome.
Yeah.
They're really, really cool.
Snoops.
Like you get them, yeah, you get them all over Spain, Portugal, into Italy and stuff. Like they're really common. And they're cool. Like I found them, like I used to teach on a field course in Spain, and you find them under big boulders down in, you know, they have the, from the heavy rain wash, kind of, it's not really a ditch, it's just to the side of the road. So you have big rocks and then you flip them, and these little guys being under it. They're the ones you see run around in Spain up the walls at night time eating moths and mosquitoes and things. But yeah, it's amazing. And came in a bunch of flowers, but it had been on a shipping container full of flowers as well. So that'll show you how hardy even the Spanish stuff, because Spain usually is seen as another part of Europe where it's almost like the Florida of Europe. It's so warm and tropical all year round. Spain gets some cold weather as well.
Yeah.
While we're talking about these little critters that sneak into the country, what do you reckon about invasive amphibians?
I think Ireland, based on what we've done, I think Irish pet owners are either exceptionally responsible. We've just been, I'd like to give people the benefit of the doubt before I tear them. Or we've been just extremely lucky, because we've been doing these surveys with the council since 2013, 14.
Surveying
the populations of amphibians, usually frogs, in a lot of Dublin City Council managed parks. And the first thing we said was, this is going to be nuts, we're going to find all sorts of crazy shit in parks that have been ditched. And we haven't found any, really, like just a turtle or two, but that's a European phenomenon, people abandoning pets in ponds. But I was expecting we'd have a similar situation to the UK, where we'd been pulling alpine newts out of almost every pond near the city, because like there's more people here, like in the rural, more rural areas and stuff, you would maybe not expect it so much. But no, they've been pretty clean. Like we had to go and do a quick rapid assessment of a toad population 4 years ago up in Donegal, and they seem to be quite happy to be where they are and not move too much. But then that's based on the surrounding habitat. It's
and they're not native.
No. Common toad, not native to Ireland, but all over the UK and the islands as well. Like, so they're on Rome, I think, and some of them. I'm not sure if they made it to the Shetlands. They may have, but they're not native to Ireland anyway.
Yep.
And they seem to be happy, but the habitat around them to let them disperse is quite hostile. There's a lot of roads as well. There was alpine newts in Galway, but that was near a garden centre, so they probably escaped, because like a lot of the garden centres would get newts in with aquatic plants. And Parks and Wildlife dealt with them, I think, around 2014. Now, I don't know if there's been any repeats. There probably should be, because saying you took four out, I've been to the pond and I've seen it, and saying you only got four animals out of it is probably a massive
underestimation.
And they found efts as well, which is a sign that they were breeding.
They found what?
Efts are their tadpoles. Their larval stage,
just before they're about to come out of water, so they have all their limbs. They're not just a head with gills looking awesome. But other than that, like, we get reports, like we have slow worms, obviously, which are non-native, but they were probably introduced. I don't know where all this probably introduced by hippies thing came from. Like, there's no evidence to suggest it was hippies. They were first seen in the early 70s, But
in the Burren, was it?
Yeah, in the Burren. But there's records of them from Sligo, Mayo. We've been sent pictures. We've been sent
Kerry.
Anecdotal evidence from Wicklow. There's a report of them in Ballyshannon, up near the border with Donegal, out on Loch Earn from the 1800s or maybe the early 1900s. Okay. So, but they were being kept as pets back then, and they were being kept as pets right up until the early 90s here. So, you know, this new age hippie thing kind of confuses me. But other than that,
what does a slow worm look like?
A slow worm's an amazing beast. Everybody thinks it's a snake, but it's actually a legless lizard. And people are like, isn't a legless lizard a snake? And it's not. It has eyelids. They blink.
Yeah.
They don't have a forked tongue. They have a bilobed tongue. So it is
split. What's bilobed?
So it has, it's not as forked as a forked tongue. It's more like two roundy bits at the end. If you ever seen that guy who wants to be a snake with all the tattoos on him, where he's had his tongue surgically cut in half.
Yeah.
It's a bit like that. Yeah. Cool thing about slow worms as well is they're very shiny in appearance, but their body, they're very much like cylindrical tubes, as you'd expect a snake would be. But if you watch a snake, you can see it breathe in and out. With a slow worm, they've got osteoderms, like crocodiles, like bony plates under their skin, so that gets them to hold their shape. So they're nearly always tubular, but that's why it's very bad to grab them and squeeze them. But they can drop their tail, so they practice autotomy like other lizards.
How do you know which is the tail and which is the body?
Because normally slow worms have this great habit of shitting all over you when you catch them.
Yes.
So they eat a lot of they eat a lot of slugs and snails, so it comes out as this thick, sticky liquid, and it's all over you. And then if you squeeze more or whatever, they're really panicky. They drop the tail, and the tail wiggles, and the head is usually the one that's. But you can see it because they've got these lovely big eyes.
Oh, right.
And like some of the males and even the females, it can be absolutely gorgeous. It's like a grey, pale grey animal with these beautiful blue spots on it. The females. Generally, and there's some that don't have this lovely kind of a chocolate brown stripe down the back, and when they're small they'd have chocolate brown flanks, and the babies are a golden yellow colour with that chocolate brown stripe. And fantastic beasts, and they seem to be happy in the Burren.
How big are they?
Maybe about, again, they can get bigger. The record I think is about 43 centimetres. So what's that in old terms? It's about 14 inches. So they can be big. And the bigger males, particularly, because males are bigger because they have these big heads, because they're not very nice with the females in the breeding season. They're a bit rough. They're not kind of considerate lovers. They grab them by the back of the head, and then because there's no limbs to hang on, they bite them. And then they mate with them as well. But the males can look very kind of, it's like a sausage really, like they can look very disproportionate because all their junk, their sexual reproductive organs, are in the tail and the base of the tail, so they could, that kind of is the skinny bit. And then they kind of get fatter as they head towards the tail. So it's they're unusual looking beasts, but they are fantastic. And like, they're probably the most widely distributed, maybe the most common reptile in the UK, because they love gardens, because people leave crap all over the place, and they like to be able to, like, it's easier to get in under something that's sheltered than have to burrow down. So they tend to do very well around gardens and with people as well, and compost heaps in particular. So they're great beasts hanging out in the west of Ireland. Very difficult to find. Very, very tough. But then the Burren itself is such a hostile, amazing place. That's probably the topic of another podcast, because we're going way off there. Yeah.
But I mean, with the introduction species, or the rumours that we've heard some funky rumours of all sorts of creatures, like toads in the Dublin Mountains and all these kind of things. So we're expecting to come across stuff, particularly like Rob was saying earlier on, in the early 90s, people were keeping great crested newts and alpine newts and all these animals in their ponds, in back gardens. So Lord knows what's out there in private areas, and as animals tend to do, they'll wander off, and we'll probably start seeing more of these interesting creatures. Now, what happens to them when they're found is a conversation we've had over many a night. So it's like, what's ethically the right thing to do if they're there for 20, 30 years? Do you nuke them from space, or do you just leave them be? Do we test them for disease? If they have no disease, should we just leave them alone, let them get on with it? You know, it's one of those, it's going to be a hard call regardless.
Yeah, I think it's going to become more complex as people move towards this ecosystem services agenda. And so ecosystem services essentially means, in very, very blunt way, and your boss in Trinity is going to hate me for saying this, is what animals do to keep the system healthy. So if we're losing some of our own animals, but there's been releases of other animals that do a similar or the same job, shouldn't we not leave them there to keep those processes going? Because it needs to be done by something, and having something doing it is better than having nothing do it.
And particularly say we were having this discussion, remember you were saying, what if somebody had released forest salamanders in Ireland 20 years ago, and there's a small population living in a forested area with one breeding pond? Now, say on the mainland Europe, they get completely wiped out, but they're in Ireland. What do you do? Do you protect that species because they're nearly extinct in the wild?
Mm.
Or do you go in and say, right, we're going to have to get rid of all these because they're non-native? Mm. So again, it's such a...
And at what point is a species considered, an invasive species considered native? You know, how long does it have to be here? Yeah. Because I think there's some animals that are here.
But that's naturalised, right? So it's the same with red deer. Everything would have had to have colonised Ireland at some point in the last 10,000 years. So are hyenas native? Because they were here before the ice.
Hmm.
Right. What about bears?
Mm. Wild boar.
Yeah.
You know.
So wolves. This then becomes, it's an almost an ecumenical discussion. You know, it's not even philosophical anymore.
Yeah.
You know, so I think things will change as they always do. And I think the first thing that should be done is if you come across an invasive species, rather than mammals tend to be bad because mammals, like, they can move around, they can reproduce highly. Herps tend to be a little bit easier because you can watch them for a couple of years and you can see, like, oh, these are naturally going to die out, because it's always, for to establish a population, you're looking at the rule of hundreds for herps. Like, you need hundreds of viable animals to keep your population going, otherwise they'll just slowly decline and die off.
Yep.
So I think a lot of it is, rather than massive expensive reaction of let's get in, get them out and kill them all, you do have time where you can go and watch them for a bit. And then if you're really worried, you just take out the adults. You don't even need to kill the juveniles. Mm. You take out the adults.
Mm.
And then you just keep, and then you just monitor the site where they breed, and then you just keep taking away the adults. And while you just can truncate the population where you just get loads of young adults, you can just keep putting away. It's much more cost effective to do it that way.
So, Rob, I have a question for you.
Yes.
You're in the critter shed with Collie and myself, and I wonder, at some point, would you take the critter shed with you later on in the future?
Absolutely. Yeah, so we'll go out and we'll get mucky. If you want to come over to the critter shed, to my critter shed / office, it's not really a critter shed.
Yeah.
My partner, Kat, she keeps loads of mantises.
Oh.
That's her thing. And
wow.
We've got a big ground boa. See, because I'm a keeper as well. So
yeah.
We've got millipedes and we've got these big silk moth caterpillars that are eating us out of house and home at the moment. Yeah, so...
Well, that sounds brilliant. Thanks so much for coming in, Rob. It was brilliant.
Very welcome. Thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.